You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Naya Yakumaki. She's talking to me from London at Whitechapel. Naya, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Naya, let's talk a little bit about what's happening at Whitechapel Gallery. Exactly what are you involved in there now, and what is your responsibilities at the gallery?
Yes, so at the Whitechapel Gallery, I am one of the four curators in the exhibitions department. I have initiated a program of exhibitions about 10 years ago that were looking at combining information together with artworks, so basically researching from archives as an alternative curatorial resource. And right now I have an exhibition which is all about the interview as a subversive platform used by artists and curators, where actually I'm very glad to be including your project at Yale Radio, Brainerd. And so, yeah, this is on until September, and it's actually going quite well. So the works from these are either works directly that resemble interviews, and they are made by artists as a commentary, or they are historical interviews, which are actually quite pertinent to today. So it's a mix of interview as a performative element and interview as a historical sort of record.
That's very interesting, because it's true with artists now, and it's how I see this series. Of course, my background is in performance art. That you see a difference between interview as having a performative element as opposed to it being research oriented. Is that both?
Yeah.
Through the lens of an artist doing them? In other words, some artists are interviewing, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but out of research incentives, reasons, and other artists are doing it as part of a perhaps social practice? Is that the distinction you're making?
Yeah, definitely, absolutely. I mean, what the idea initiated from the fact that the interview as a platform was always sort of academic and a very accepted way of understanding an artist's work. And initially it was done through publication, so it was an interview that then became a text. So the audio, oral side of it wasn't really important. But and so whilst this was happening, we had examples of male art historians interviewing very known male artists such as, you know, David Sylvester and Francis Bacon, or Pierre Caban interviewing Marcel Duchamp. So my idea for the exhibition started from the very last paragraph of Pierre Caban's interviews, 6-month-long interviews with Marcel Duchamp, where Pierre Caban thanks Duchamp and says, is there anything I haven't asked you? Please, that's the time to now say it. And Duchamp goes, you've never asked me how I am. And so basically this very profound exchange between the two men actually ends up being Duchamp wanting a very normal encounter of how he actually is, how his health is in particular. So that triggered the idea. And of course, in the research, I found so many artists that have worked with the interview as a performative element, and, you know, discussing politics or making it as a psychoanalytic having a psychoanalytic approach to their work. Marcel Brothier's interview with a cat, which is very much about the art world and the art market, so it's a commentary on that. So I'm looking at it mostly at this subversive angle that artists have given to it, but also curators have given it that angle. For instance, Hans-Ulrich Obrist did the 24-hour long interviews. William Furlong for Audio Arts in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, did recorded interviews with artists who were performing or just reading texts. Kevin Atherton in Two Minds also interviews himself and challenges him, you know, for things he said a year ago. So there's a great array of actually interviews in here. And of course, we were very interested in Yale radio interviews because it's also a very different methodology, how someone calls a number and there they are interviewed by someone they've never met before. And I think we were interested in all those different ways of conducting contemporary interviews today.
Well, and then there's the notion of, I mean, it sounds like in the exhibition, most of this is audio. But of course, when, as you were saying, so many audio interviews get translated into text. And I don't know how you feel about that. My feeling is always that when you translate it into text, I've translated some into the text, but then you show it to the person that's being interviewed, and the text starts getting altered because nobody really likes to see themselves in text the way they actually speak. So then there's a different kind of interview when the person who is being interviewed starts picking through the text and altering the text to change their responses to answers. For grammar, it could seem, is the initial reason, but often the content begins to change. So in this exhibition, is this all audio, or is there also text, or?
So there is audio, there is film, and there is text as well. So I included a lot of different manifestations of the interview, and you're very right in saying, of course, that when it's scripted or it becomes into text, it becomes something else. First of all, you lose, you know, the you lose the pauses, you lose the timing of an interview. So you lose the process of thinking as well, because, you know, like now we're talking and I have gaps in my sort of speech because I want to pause and think. I think with transforming an interview into text, this whole thing is lost. So there are some, there's quite a lot of video interviews actually. One that is from the mid-60s, from the Belgian TV by James Lee Byers, where he had a two-hour live broadcast where he was interviewing members of the audience that would call into the studio. So very performative, of course, but quite radical and innovative for television history. And then there's an interview with John Cage where the interviewer has laryngitis. So they whisper. The interviewer whispers, and I thought it was so amazing because of Cage's sort of relationship with sound and pauses and silence. And so I think it's a show which might be of interest to you, but as well. There's also a group of curators called the Drawing Room Confession, where they do exactly what you were saying. They interview an artist, but then they edit it so heavily with the artist, with guests, and it becomes three or four different interviews, and then they put all this together in a book, and it just takes a different life. And they also have a live element where this is performed, so it's quite an analytic look. I also wanted to say, because you said your background is in performance, the next show actually we open in September here, it's entirely to do with performance art, and it has to do with Performa, the institution, its history and its commissions in New York City. So we're actually working very along the lines of investigating performance in different ways, both with the interviews and then as a more historical medium.
It's very interesting. I was really smiling when you were talking about the John Cage interview and the others. There's some things that are, you know, can be very unusual. I once interviewed the artist William Pope L, and which is in this series. But he said to me, I'll do this series. And I was in the biennial with him in Whitney, like what, several years ago. But so I knew him from that. But he said to me, Brainerd, I'll do this interview with you, but I don't want to speak English. I want to speak in my own made-up language. So I said, okay. And really, because we were, I think, both artists, or because I am, I could handle it. But I'd say, today we're talking with William Pope L, and he'd say, And I'd say, so William, tell me about what you're working on now. And he'd say, well, and he would, you know, it's incomprehensible, but it was nonsense. And I had to play the straight man and say, oh, I understand. And where is that being shown now?
So you were responding to the incomprehensible. That's amazing. If I'd known about it, it would probably be in the show. But it's the same when Warhol asks his interviewer, they ask him a very serious question about pop art, and he goes, can I just respond, blah, blah, blah? And, she says, yes, of course. And he goes, yeah, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, it's this sort of negation of language,
We could talk about the interview for this whole series. this whole conversation. I want to ask you a little bit about what you said earlier at Whitechapel. You're both involved in a research process. You were saying, as well as something else. So the interviews is, would that be considered the research process? Okay. Kind of show as opposed to I forgot the other word you were using, research as opposed to
archive,
archiving, curating, in terms of how you're managing things.
Mm-hmm. My approach at the Whitechapel, because I have a life outside the Whitechapel, but at the Whitechapel I specifically run research led exhibitions. So they are generated by us here, and they are a process that changes continuously until the point where we say stop, now we have to finalize and exhibit that. So it's quite a different process than working directly with an artist or putting up a group show. Information brings different avenues continuously, and at some point I decide where we want to stop, because my interest is really how you build up historiographies that are not so known to the public, and how the canonical art history or curating history has sort of omitted certain artists or movements, or whether these are women artists or men artists, or certain countries have been omitted, So I think we're very much looking at what has not registered in the canonical art history. And so they are research projects that start from scratch. There are three different strands we develop here, and this one with the interviews is one of the strands where we look at we try to bring a new platform for research, for curatorial research. So there are interviews that haven't been shown before, apart from Marcel Brothier's interview with a cat, which is a very famous one. Mm. Everything else is sort of researched by us. Of course, I wouldn't dare say the word discovered, because they pre-existed, but they weren't considered as an artwork necessarily, or they were not considered in relation to one another. So very much strong interest in research, curating, bringing new histories to the foreground, and also challenging information that exists in archives, in institutional archives in particular.
So it's partly, revising history to some extent when we talk about, or you talked about what's omitted from history, such as, women and minorities, people from certain countries, or mm-hmm. or white men or others that are overlooked somehow. That would seem a particularly difficult task, because you're looking for artists that haven't been given much visibility. So my question is, how do you find those that haven't been found, essentially?
Well, exactly. That's a difficult one, because for me to have found them, it means that they are already out there, it's something that maybe it's discussed through my peers. But actually, many times, the idea for exhibitions come through a bunch of documents that I come across in an archive, or I might be talking to an academic, or from different disciplines, an academic specialized in Iranian performance, or an academic of design history, and they may share with me some information about a movement or a moment, And so I start research from there. So, yeah, I can't spend all my time sort of looking into the archives, but I think a lot of it has to do also that working for an institution such as the Whitechapel Gallery, which focuses on mid-career contemporary artists, anything that comes as a new narrative can be innovative for our audiences. So, you know, any history that we have to, we can share, wouldn't have been seen before, because when they come to Whitechapel, they expect to see a solo show or a group show of an artist that is either at the mid-career or at the beginning of their career. So this comes as a little different story. And in fact, the archive gallery that I'm responsible for has gained over the years its own audience, because they know they'd come in, there'd be something that possibly has a lot of text and a few screens or audio, but actually it's something that has a story to tell. And yeah, so it works through, I would say, associations and combinations between the material. I like that, sort of the contradicting, one material contradicts the other, or challenges the history of the gallery itself. I'm not sure how my colleagues feel about that, but I sort of like to play with information and what that, you know, shows us.
Well, I think that's important, what you said, to challenge the history of the gallery itself, you know, and whether your colleagues are you know, liking that or not. But that seems to be so much what is important to do now, because in terms of the research you're doing, part of what I would imagine you're bringing light to is the bias of the gallery in the past, or at least the lens that they were looking through, which is very different than what we're doing in a contemporary context. So, or what you're doing right now. So, in terms of the past of the Whitechapel Gallery, do you mean how they selected artists in the past, how they produced exhibitions?
Yeah, as well, and also what misconceptions we had about some of our shows. Sometimes we showed, I emphasized on exhibitions that were not popular at all when they were first introduced to the public, like in the 50s or 60s or later. But looking at them now, they are so much more pertinent and relevant to today's debate in the art world. So, you know, I looked at a show that took place in 54 that was all about folklore and craft. And at the time, it didn't mean anything to the art world. But the last 20 years, knowing how much artists have been interested in the folklore and the handmade and the, you know, the crafted, from Alan Dane, you know, to other artists, that suddenly had a new significance, and we were able to find new links between popular art and pop art at the time, because through the research we discovered that the popular artists we were presenting were actually in dialogue with pop artists such as Eduardo Paolozzi, Nigel Henderson. So, you know, all of that just came out of an interest in something that was not interesting, basically, you know, according to the registered history. It was an exhibition that wasn't so successful, it finished, but now it became really successful and pertinent because we had different, you know, glasses looking at it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is a lot of what I do here.
It's very interesting. So to move on to one other thing, I know you were involved in the Athens Biennial. You were the director of research there, and I imagine still are involved in that. Can you tell me a little bit about what your role was there?
Yeah, so I'm a co-director there. My title is what you say, but I'm actually co-running the organization since September 2016. I was invited to this role. It's in Athens, of course, so I do spend my time going back and forth. This was quite an important time, not just for the Athens Biennial, but for, of course, Greece in particular. We had a huge art institution, Documenta, landing in the country, and so it was really important for us to think of a response to what was going on that also addressed the financial crisis, the European identity crisis, and other sort of issues that maybe Documenta didn't want to address. So We devised a series of actions instead of an exhibition this time. We didn't have a show. We just had 2 weeks of actions, stroke performances, that addressed these issues. And yeah, it was what we wanted to say. So we abstained from having an exhibition. We didn't want to be part of the big art party that was going on around us. Suddenly Greece is the focus of the art world, and 5 years ago nobody knew anything about it. So it was very interesting for me as a Greek person to observe this from my position here in the sort of UK art world. So yeah, we did what we had to do, and now we're working on the next biennial, which will take place in April 18.
And will that biennial...
And our title, oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, go on. So tell me a little bit. Perhaps tell me a little bit about. So in the next biennial, or you could tell me what you were just going to say. Is it a? Will there be a similar approach, or how will it differ?
Yeah, it will be a similar approach, because we titled our series of actions "Waiting for the Barbarians," and so we had our actions, and then we kickstarted a year of active waiting for the Barbarians, in parentheses, and the actual Biennale starts in April 18 with the same title. Waiting for the Barbarians is the title of a Greek poem written by Kostas Kavafis. A lot of press and the art world just linked it that the Barbarians were the Documenta, or the Barbarians are the Germans, or, you know, whatever, nationalistic things. But actually, what we are working with is the recent changes in the US politics and across the world, that Barbarians are each one of us. And that, are looking at the state of affairs maybe in the world right now, which means that we do not only include artworks, we include a lot of items or things we find online, and there is a particular sort of thematic, and it progresses under the title Waiting for the Barbarians. As I mentioned before, it could be each one of us for each other.
I like that, and I want to ask you one thing about the actions that you said were taking place or have already taken place. You know, and I love both ideas of them. You know, are seem to be staking out such independent territory, such unique approaches, as opposed to the typical approach to a biennial, where it's just an enormous amount of artists doing all kinds of different things. So, and usually, you know, visual art exhibitions. So, in the one where there was just action that has in the Athens biennial, can you tell me maybe mention one or two of the actions so I get a picture of what was happening there?
Yeah, of course. So one action was commissioned. It was an audio music action. It was commissioned for the facade of our building, which is a large late 19th century hotel in the middle of the city. It's disused and derelict, but we operate through that. And because we had no exhibition, this building was empty, of course. So we worked on the facade of the building. We commissioned an audio piece that actually resembled a call from a monarch or a totalitarian regime, and we've installed tannoy systems all around where we were. And there was a particular sound piece that, as I said, it had elements from historical but also totally made up calls to the crowd. And then a tenor arrived at one of the balconies and was singing. And it was a piece that actually stopped the traffic around the building. It was our building is at a very busy square in the center of Athens, and taxi drivers and motorbikes were stopping because it had an impact. And we really much wanted to alert people, you know, what we're living through. And so some people didn't understand what it was, but so you can see the nature of it. It was announced, and it just started at a particular time and lasted 20 minutes. Another action was the wandering at our empty building, where we would welcome people as normal that would come for the Athens Biennale, and they would wander in this five-story, huge, empty hotel. And then, of course, we would let them know why we abstained from the big Documenta party. We had another action where the five curators, including myself, under the provocative title Heart and Sword Division, played mm-hmm. with the ideas of over-identification. And so we were dressed as local pirates from the Peloponnese, and we had speeches during the performative press conference that we didn't believe in. I was all about the transcendental nature of art. My colleague was about the community participation in art. But all of us presented a particular ideology that is right now very, very dominant within the arts, and of course there are so many. And so that was another action. It was a press conference, but it was totally performative. And so, yeah, you understand sort of the nature of things. So one action followed the other. There was a strict timing, and whoever came from the beginning, I think they must have left from that building at midnight with a very, very powerful, perhaps, encounter that was quite cryptical as well. They weren't sure exactly what it was. There was a lot of international audience as well who didn't know who we were, what the Biennale is, but there was some element of critical perspective, I think, that in the end you left with. So we're quite pleased of how it went.
That's very exciting. It sounds like an enormous amount of fun, too, if I can use that word, as opposed to, you know, an academic approach to putting together an exhibit, which I admire and so many curators use. This sounds like from the tenor, which was obviously also gorgeous, that really moved me just hearing about the traffic stopping and imagining the singing. Mm. But to the press conference, that just sounds, makes me smile. It sounds like the curators were having a tremendous amount of fun.
We had a lot of fun we had a lot of fun, and we had very long discussions, and I felt more as if I was an artist working rather than a curator engaged to an institutional platform. It was really a very interesting process to be there for a month and work with the rest of the team. So yeah, we also laughed a lot and argued a lot. So
I love that. Before I ask you the last question, is there anything else you want to say about Whitechapel or what's coming up or anything at all?
I think that we have so many exhibitions to tell you what's coming up might be maybe overwhelming, but that we have five shows per time. But I think what is interesting about the gallery right now in this moment in its history is that we're able through our program to work on different curatorial strands. So one is commissions, the other is presenting solo shows, the other is working entirely with collections of art, the other is the archive strand that I said. So I'm quite, as a curator, I'm quite animated actually working here, because there are a lot of interesting projects that trigger my interests. We will have a busy year ahead, but I wouldn't take you into detail to what we have, because we have many things going on. So
Naya, let me ask you the last question. I'm wondering what you're reading at the moment. It could be off topic or not.
Okay, well, I'm actually as normal. I've got two books on my side table, but now I'm reading a book that it's actually came out about maybe 12 years ago or 15. It's I think it might be a little bit of a cliche, but it's a David Harvey's book, A Brief History of Neoliberalism. And I'm saying it's a cliche because it's been read a lot, maybe, and quoted a lot, but I really felt the need to go back to it, especially working for the Waiting for the Barbarians, you know, exhibition, and just recap to how we, according to David Harvey, how we have arrived where we are. And the other is a book that just came out actually 2 weeks ago by a colleague of mine, which is the radio works of Robert Rauschenberg and John Cage. And so I've just started that, and I'm very interested to see, because she's done amazing research on the radio works that they did. And that's it, really, what I'm reading. But there's other books there that I actually have given up on reading because there's no time.
Right. Naya, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's really a great pleasure to have you in our show and also talking to you as an interviewer.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.